Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, you and I have both been fascinated and somewhat skeptical about the driverless car. And we've done other podcasts on it. As you recall, we had the traffic czar of New York City, that wonderful man, talking about it. Well, this is another take on this whole issue. And it's certainly worth considering. There's so much investment going on in autonomous vehicle technology.
Yeah, I don't really get it. I don't know. It's not something that I prefer. Now, assist is good. I think the new braking systems, the new alarm systems on the car, you leaving the road, take your eyes off the road. You know, a smart car isn't bad, but I still like being the driver behind the wheel.
Well, you still like listening to I Get Around by the Beach Boys while you're driving them. I mean, I know that. But you're going to be really, I think, very interested in what Anthony Townsend has to say, because he agrees that there's a lot of hype. And what is the reality on the road? What is really going to happen? And I think he's got a different take on how we're going to ghost these roads. For example, I think he thinks that there'll be a lot more activity with autonomous vehicles during the off hours. I mean, think about it this way, John. All the e-commerce that is going on today. And, of course, we know that recently Amazon bought a fleet of driverless vehicles. And he thinks that we may see a lot of the activity as it relates to autonomy late at night on a road.
Well, that would be the safest place.
Well, where they all fan out like little ghosts into the night, John. And they can deliver. Now, that might mean, for example, that at the top of my street, which is a little cul-de-sac, maybe we have these new Amazon boxes, and these little autonomous vehicles go up to them, and there's something that indicates that's my slot, and they put the box in, and it locks behind it. And, you know, these could be big, like you've got safety deposit boxes or post boxes today at the post office, that he's thinking about lots of things, even moving buildings, things that could be moved around during the late hours or off hours when we're not on the roads.
Well, they're also, I mean, it's a little off the subject, but they're also working on drones to deliver your...
Oh, absolutely. But he's just saying that, you know, this technology, we think about it more for the passenger car experience, but it might be used in many other ways.
Trucking, absolutely,
that we're not considering. So rather than me trying to explain a little bit of a different approach to the way you and I have been talking about it, let's let Anthony Townsend do the work for us. The book is called Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car on America Trends.
We are ready to hit the ghost road today on America Trends with Anthony M. Townsend. And he's written a book called Ghost Road, Beyond the Driverless Car. And Anthony, this isn't the first time that on this podcast we have addressed the issue of the driverless future. I did with Sam Schwartz, who is the traffic guru from New York City. And he's very excited about the future of driverless vehicles. You have a more nuanced look at what the future may bring to us. And you look at freight as perhaps being more likely than those of us who have been driving for years giving up that privilege.
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly in light of the fast-forward leap that we've taken in the last 6 months under the various shutdowns related to coronavirus, where we've essentially moved about 5 years forward in terms of adoption and frequency of shopping online and how much e-commerce we're doing. You know, delivery is a big part of the economy now. And companies like Amazon, which are losing, say, $3-4 on every package they ship to us, had already been looking at automation as a way of cutting those costs. And now it's really an existential crisis. So just today, leaked that Amazon is acquiring Zoox, a Silicon Valley-based autonomous driving startup for over $1 billion. And that's really just another signal that, you know, the center of gravity in automated driving, I think, is shifting from moving people, which has always been sort of speculative investment, towards moving goods, which the economic case is really there right now.
But it may be speculative, yet it seems highly involved that there are so many companies, tech companies, car companies, companies that we've never heard of, working on this, assuming that they're going to be pushing us out of the driver's seat and into the passenger seat. Are they wrong in their assumptions?
They may be. I mean, time will tell. There certainly are not a lot of people lining up in dealer showrooms right now demanding self-driving cars. Tesla, GM, a handful of others have had some limited success selling cars that have some rather limited self-driving features. But it's been 10 years this October since Google unveiled, you know, what was then their secret self-driving car project. And part of the reason why we've seen so much investment in self-driving car technology, particularly by the big automakers, is because they were scared. They were crawling out of recession. GM and Ford were both crawling, or sorry, GM and Chrysler, I think, were both crawling out of bankruptcy at the time. You know, they needed to be seen as keeping up with Silicon Valley, you know, sort of coming after their core business. And I think a lot of that fear is what has driven the hype around self-driving vehicles over the last decade. And a lot of that was what I, you know, really wanted to cut through with the book. It's not to say that self-driving technology is not moving forward and moving forward quickly, but I think it's about much more than driverless cars. And in many ways, you know, looking at the driverless passenger car as the thing that's you know, really going to deliver the goods, that's the hardest of all of the problems. And we're much more likely to see this technology show up in more specialized vehicles doing more specialized things in more limited domains that have, you know, very clear business case. So, you know, and I see like Hitachi, which is the world's largest maker of motorized wheelchairs, developing prototypes of self-driving wheelchairs that they want to put into airports and nursing homes and other places where, you know, we need to move lots of people very cost-effectively who aren't able to move around on their own in a very controlled environment. That, to me, seems like something that could come much more quickly and be the way that a lot of people experience a self-driving vehicle for the first time.
Well, you also talk about the fact that moving people isn't the killer app for automated vehicles or autonomous vehicles. It's moving stuff. Having said that, if we're going to be building all of these vehicles to move stuff and they're going to be on the same roadways or some other platform upon which they can traverse the same environment that we're traversing, I've always worried about the notion that you're going to have driver and driverless whatever vehicles or whatever variety of jitney and form in terms of taxis and the like we have. How dangerous is that for those of us who are still driving and those that are self-involved?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to be a mix. I, except in very limited situations, am against the idea of segregating or creating separated spaces for automated vehicles. In fact, that is the literal embodiment of this idea of the ghost road, a space that's completely dominated by machines. I think that would be repeating many of the mistakes we made in the 20th century of creating spaces that are dominated by automobiles. We'd be surrendering a lot of our world to this technology in the same way we did with the automobile. The reality is that even the worst computer driver is probably going to be significantly better at driving than the majority of human drivers, you know, in the U.S.
But why do we not think that? I mean, you point in the book that I think 73% of us are skeptical as to the ability to traverse the roads without us being right there commandeering whatever it is that we're doing. Why are we so skeptical?
There's a lot of reasons. I mean, first, we haven't seen it yet. So, with very few exceptions, most of us have never, you know, had a direct contact with this technology. It just simply isn't here yet. It's in large part still imagination. There's been a lot of on-road testing, and there have been some accidents and there's some fatal crashes. And, you know, the few products that are out there, they do have flaws. And I think, I don't want to say that there's been an unfair amount of attention, but there's been a lot more scrutiny of the failures than there have been of, you know, millions of miles of successful driving. If we scrutinized every crash, every fatal car crash where a human being was involved, you know, our motor safety laws would be a lot more stringent than they are now. We tend, you know, to tolerate human error much more than machine error, and that's actually a well-researched fact. So I think a lot of this, and a lot of people in the industry, believe that as we become exposed to the technology, that hesitation is actually going to fade quite quickly, and there's some evidence to that. But, you know, there is a taint, I think, to some of the negative impacts of rapid technological change that has just permeated throughout society in the 10 years since Google announced this project, their self-driving car project, that I think is going to affect, you know, people's perceptions. I mean, to put it like in a bigger perspective, this is our first encounter as humanity with artificial intelligence in the real world in a form that's big enough to kill us. If it goes awry.
You mean Alexa?
So this is about. I mean, it can, but not like this, you know. And so this is where a lot of the sort of worst, you know, sci-fi nightmares start to potentially come true, or at least, you know, the cause and effect is a little bit clearer than it is, you know, when you're in the sort of murky mists of cyberspace and bad things are happening, you don't really quite understand it.
Well, you point in the book to a lot of things that we don't yet see, but you have studied and you see. There's a term called drayage, a key focus of autonomous vehicles, mules, driverless shuttles, civic caravans, urban ushers. Give us a little bit of a scenario if we went forward, because this is a podcast that looks at trends, where we're going. And if we could see 20 years into the future, and let's say we're still driving cars that we are commandeering, we are still the driver, what else are we going to see on the roads if you could imagine 20 years down the road?
It depends on what kind of road you're driving on. The kinds of automated vehicles that you see in the city are going to be different from the kinds that you see in a suburb or the kinds that you see out in the countryside. And that's really, I think, the big story. And, you know, the subtitle of the book, Beyond the Driverless Car, is that this tremendous variety that the digital world has given to us is now going to carry over into this world of electric automated vehicles. You know, you don't need to try to make a 2-ton box, you know, with a 200 horsepower engine and 4 wheels, you know, be the solution to everything. You can make it bigger or smaller or slower or faster. And so I think it really it depends on where you are and even when you are, actually, is really interesting, because when you take the human out of the picture, you can use the full 24 hours of the day in all kinds of really interesting ways. And particularly when it comes to moving freight, I think that the night, and particularly the really, you know, wee hours of the morning start to become activated, especially in big cities where you want to keep the streets clear during the day of heavy vehicles, so that people can walk, people can cycle, and people can use the streets for shopping and eating, and do all the deliveries at night. And even assuming that the receiving is automated too, and that a truck or a van or even a small delivery bot can pull up to a building, kind of dock with the side of the building, deliver what it needs to, and then scoot off, and do so quietly because it's electric. And so I imagine one of the most jarring scenes will be, you know, what it's like to walk around a big city, you know, in the middle of the night, years in the future. And streets won't be quiet. They'll be filled with things big and small, buzzing and thundering around. Some of them moving very, very quickly because there's nothing, you know, really stopping them. The risk is very low when people aren't around. And, you know, they can take high G turns and do all kinds of crazy things. And some of them, you know, massive, moving very, very slowly. Even, you know, small buildings might be on the move. Now, if you saw when the space shuttle was moved from the Port of Long Beach to the California Science Museum, that was a massive endeavor. And that kind of thing could become a routine event in cities and done completely automated. You know, we might see entire facilities, you know, roaming around cities, whether it's a shop, you know, moving to the next neighborhood for customers, or a social service center, you know, or a school.
Yeah, that was hard for me to even envision, but I get your point. And a lot of people were talking about the space shuttle that Elon Musk, working with NASA, developed, and it didn't look like that which we had seen in the past. So what does this stuff look like? Does it look like a computer? Does it look like some kind of digital ship? What does it look like to you, as best you can tell, as it's being now prototyped around the world?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is stuff for future architects to design. I think the point that I was trying to make is that, you know, it's gonna become more and more unclear what the boundary between a robot, an automated vehicle, and a mobile building is in the future. And so, you know, who's an architect, who's a vehicle designer, and who's a roboticist? I think it'll be very hard to tell the difference, because robots will start to behave more like vehicles, you know, moving outside of buildings and out into the real world and traveling around cities and doing things. You know, vehicles will be able to manipulate things around them. You know, you may have a delivery van that can pick something up and put something down. And again, I think we're going to see all kinds of you know, small structures that can move and open and unfold and change shape in ways that, you know, make them more mobile and less permanent than they have been in the past.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services, from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future, so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
All right, we're taking a trip down Ghost Road with Anthony Townsend, Beyond the Driverless Car. This is something that people might really be able to visualize. So if you could illustrate the point that you made in the book about Amazon-style autonomous vehicles. Now, you just talked about them purchasing a company, I believe, today. But this last-mile delivery density issue, so many people today, during this COVID-19 crisis, are having things delivered. And we know that the U.S. Postal Service is in some difficulty, but they're still there, and there's a box in front of every home. And yet there are some boxes from Amazon that are dropped at my neighbors because they always get it wrong, or dropped on my front porch or on the driveway. What do you see happening in the future, this last mile delivery density issue, if we're all basically buying online?
I mean, the number of deliveries is definitely going to increase. There will be more types of services. So there's bulk items that you know, reorder every week or every month that have to be delivered regularly. But it's okay if they come a day late or a day early or even a week later, a week early, as long as they keep coming. There's stuff that you want instantly. You know, you order some food and you need it delivered fresh. And then there's stuff in between. There's also a tremendous number of returns, far more than there ever were before, because companies are competing on service and trying to replicate the in-store experience. Something like 25 to 35% of apparel that's ordered on Amazon. So people are treating their living rooms like the fitting room, you know, and they're ordering things they want to try on and then sending them back. And so the whole delivery ecosystem is having to diversify, increase capacity, increase performance, and automation is an absolutely essential part of making all of that work at scale, at a cost that these companies can, you know, afford to be profitable. Amazon, I think, costs them something like $3 to $4 per parcel right now to put something on your front door. If you go to someplace like China, which, you know, population density is a lot higher, labor costs are lower, and they, you know, built the delivery system from scratch in the last 10 years. It cost them about a tenth of that. They also have a lot more automation in the core part of the network. So I think that's where we're headed in the U.S. is, you know, can we do that for 10% of what it costs us to do it now? And if we can, how much more of it are we going to use? And I think, you know, the answer is quite a bit. We're going to see all kinds of businesses start to use shipping, use delivery as a way of connecting to their customers in a way that they use stores and retail locations to do now. And the COVID shutdowns has just been a giant natural experiment in seeing how flexible and how, you know, agile businesses are at adapting to that. And I think, you know, we're already headed in that direction. This just gives us a big, big push forward. And now we're going to.
Yeah, you said, I think, at the beginning, about 5 years forward in our thinking about this, just as we have with telemedicine, as we have with working tele-networking out of the home and such. Anthony, you postulated in the book that all taxis could be automated by 2030, and Uber and Lyft, another million by that time. It's easier, it's cheaper. What does this scenario look like as we're still driving our own passenger vehicles, so you've got the ghosts and the humans interacting on the roads?
I think any future that we move into with automated driving, we're going to have a mix of all different kinds of fully human-driven, partially human, partially computer-driven, and fully computer-driven vehicles on the road, in addition to having a much greater variety of shapes and sizes and speeds of vehicles once computer control comes into the picture. And so, you know, I think the whole driving environment on the roadway is just going to be a lot more heterogeneous than it is today, which goes really against, I think, the expectations that have been set for us by science fiction writers, by, you know, movies, and by car companies and tech companies over the last decade, that is going to be this kind of, you know, future of pod cars moving in perfect synchronization. And so we're looking at actually a much more complex flow of traffic, much more complex driving environment out on the road. You know, that sounds more chaotic. I think it actually can still be safer. But whether it means more or less congestion and kind of, you know, the flow of traffic getting stuck because nobody really knows, you know, what the person or the ghost next to them is going to do in any given situation, you know, that remains to be seen.
If we're all going to get excited about what this future of more autonomous vehicles might look like, you put forward three reasons to be enthused, and I'd like you to put just a little bit of commentary to each. One is that automobile killing on the roads can be stopped. Play out the numbers, because it does seem like a rather deadly game, but we don't consider it that.
Yeah, in the U.S., we still have 50 or 60,000 people die every year in car crashes. It's presumed, and it's likely that many, if not most of those, will be eliminated by automated driving. I think that's one of the big promises. It's the one that's probably the most likely to be delivered upon. I dedicated the book to my uncle, who died in a car accident more than a decade before I was even born, and I never met him. And many of the people who are involved in creating this technology have those kinds of personal stories of loss. You know, it's like a million people a year worldwide. Depending on, you know, how you do the math, more people were killed in the 20th century by automobiles than died in World War II. So, you know, it's just been a tremendous loss of life. You know, we have no idea beyond the emotional toll, you know, what the contributions to society and the economy, science, the arts, you know, that those people might have made had they not, you know, been prematurely killed by this technology. So I think there's a tremendous amount to gain there. And then, you know, you have all of the people who weren't even in a motor vehicle, pedestrians, cyclists, who are trying to make more responsible mobility choices, who are sort of sideswiped, you know, off the road by people who are making somewhat more selfish decisions to travel, you know, by high speed, high energy consumption means. And I think automated vehicles are likely to be better able to provide the room and, you know, adhere to operating guidelines that protect spaces for pedestrians and cyclists. Which is where,
well, they have sensors and they have eyes in the back of their heads, which we don't, and never.
Yeah, and they can be restricted in ways that human drivers are less willing and able to be restricted.
Ah, yeah, well, we've seen during the pandemic, certain people are just unwilling to care about the societal risk involved. Let me ask you about traffic congestion, because you suggest that it could, in some ways, disappear, not because there are going to be so few things rolling around, because, in fact, that's not the case, but because of location tracking technology that can make us so much more aware of where traffic is and move us around in different ways.
Yeah, I don't think traffic congestion is likely to disappear. I think automation is going to probably drive the cost of most kinds of vehicular travel down, because it'll, you know, allow fleets to be more efficiently managed. It'll allow travel to be managed so that we won't drive into congested areas. You know, we'll travel at night, and so people are going to travel more because it'll be cheaper. Mm. And the question is, you know, can we incentivize them to not all try to do it at the same time and in the same place? And that's where the programmability of an automated transportation system, not just vehicles, starts to become really exciting. So the kinds of things that we've seen get deployed in ride-hail systems, like surge pricing and incentives for shared rides, and other kinds of essentially mobility markets. These are policy ideas that have been around for a long time, but very few governments have had the power to put them in place, you know, that got sort of stood up with a piece of software. You know, those things become much more commonplace, and we start to see much more fluid way of influencing how people make their travel decisions that smooths out some of the bumps and allows us to spread out the demand a little bit better. And, you know, I think the real power of automation, again, is unlocking the things that people can't do and moving a lot of the movement of freight and goods, which is really surging already from e-commerce, and now with the transition to kind of post-pandemic reality, moving that to the nighttime when roads are underutilized is a real possibility to kind of stretch the capacity of our roads for moving people during the day.
So we may not see all those drivers at the side of the road in their trucks at night when we're traveling. You say that no one will be left behind by autonomous vehicles. There will be great social and economic benefits for all. Play that out just briefly for us.
Well, so this is one of the promises of the industry. You know, when Google unveiled their self-driving car project 10 years ago this fall, they staged a series of test drives with senior citizens who were mobility impaired, visually impaired people who, you know, would never be able to drive a car themselves because they couldn't see the road. They didn't put children in the cars because I think they were a little bit afraid of the insinuation there. But that's another group that can't drive who could benefit tremendously from you know, having their own access to automobiles. You know, there's a lot of people who used to be able to get around on the transportation systems we had before automobiles who are left out because they really just could never master the skill of navigating this 2-ton machine, which is really the most complex technical task that most people learn how to do in their lives. Automated driving will bring that, you know, to them for the first time. The question is, though, you know, at what cost? And will they be able to pay? And if they're not able to pay, how will they get access to that? And industry hasn't really answered that. You know, the best answer so far has been that, well, you know, for those who can't afford their own private self-driving cars, it will be shared self-driving vehicles, you know, Ubers and Lyfts and whatnot. But the appeal of shared taxis has been limited so far. Those companies actually lose more on shared rides than they do on, I mean, they lose money on every ride. They lose more on shared rides. Shared rides are mostly a customer acquisition marketing strategy for them right now. It's sort of the gateway drug to the private rides, which they make more money on. There's lots of reasons why we don't want everybody in cars in the first place. You know, if all of the poor people in the world suddenly stopped riding trains and buses and started riding around in even shared taxis, we would have a massive traffic problem in every city on the planet. And so these things are all connected. I think it's just been sort of a real lack of vision, lack of understanding about how the whole transportation system works. So I think there are going to be big opportunities for automated vehicles to come in and do some sort of precision bombing, provide new mobility solutions. You know, people who are, you know, medically disabled and can't get out to get to the bus stop or get to the train station, and now depend on these dial-a-ride services that they have to book a day in advance and cost cities $20, $30, $40 a ride to fulfill. Automation is going to really power some real new solutions there. So I think there are a lot of exciting options.
You also describe two versions of the driverless future, the self-driving suburbs or the car-like communes. Mm-hmm. Which is more likely, and what are they, very briefly?
So they're basically two really oversimplified visions of what the larger impact on the structure of cities and land use is going to be. You know, whether this sort of reflecting a debate in the urban planning community about whether we're more likely to see more sprawl, people using automated vehicles, mostly private ones, to move further out from cities because they're willing to tolerate very long trips because they don't have to focus on driving. They can do other things. They can work. Mm-hmm. They can relax. Or whether automation is going to reduce the cost of services like Uber and Lyft and deliveries through high density, you know, delivery, automated delivery networks like Amazon Prime to such a degree that, you know, cities just become very high mobility zones, very cheap, and that becomes a big draw you know, really boosts the prospects of cities and makes living in cities very attractive. And there have been arguments on both sides. And really what I was saying is that neither of those is likely to be true. automation isn't going to tip the balance in one way or another. It's going to make both of them possible. It remains to be seen sort of, you know, what other forces will drive it towards one or the other. And I sort of came out slightly in favor of the more urban side, that I thought on net automation was going to be more of a centralizing force that would concentrate investment and activity, mostly because it would make distance more of a factor in the pricing of transportation, both for moving people and for moving goods. Whereas now you buy a car and you just want to use it as much as you can because you've already sunk so much money into it. Since I wrote that, we've had this pandemic. I think that there's a lot more interest in spreading out. And I think we're going to see a lot more of an interest in looking at automated vehicles as a tool that supports more spreading out. You know, we've already seen some really interesting startups come out of China just in the last couple of months. There was one that was doing contactless delivery of medicines inside some of the hospitals in Wuhan that were treating COVID. They've now taken those same robots that they developed and are using them to power contactless restaurants where the food comes by robot to your table. It's a little bit of a gimmick, but what it does is it says, you know, that there is a demand, there's interest in developing these technologies, and they'll get tested in the market, and, you know, we'll see whether it becomes an appealing way of reorganizing, you know, our world so that people can breathe a little bit easier and sort of feel a little bit safer, yet still be connected to the things they want to be connected to.
In closing, in the book, you point out that from 1920 to 1980, we went up to full motorization. We really became enamored with the car. It became a symbol of America. Then in 1980 to 2020, it was saturation, a lot of gridlock, frustration, not investing in the infrastructure to support it. And yet we do love many of the features of this gig technology in our cars. We love the self-parking. We love the blind spot, those of us who have it. And you point out that we go way back to cruise control as one of the first identifiers of the way that we could kind of separate ourselves from the art and craft of driving. Mm-hmm. And now you tell us that automation may play out in a single generation, the next 20 or 30 years. So what you're seeing with the way we're adapting to the new technology in our cars today, how important has that adaptation been, plus all the investment that's taken place in this new technology over the last couple of years on the part of gig companies and automakers too? You really think 20 to 30 years down the road, we will have adapted to a much greater sense of what these ghost roads might look like?
People zero in on cars and they say, you know, when are we going to, every car on the highway going to be self-driving? I have no idea. It may be 2100 before that happens. But I guarantee by 2030, you know, everyone that's listening to this now will have spent a good bit of their time in or on some kind of conveyance that is driving itself a good bit of the time. It may be a car. It may be a scooter, it might be a wheelchair, or it might just be something that makes a daily delivery to their front door. But this technology is going to find its way into our lives through a dozen different paths. It's not just going to be one path.
Very interesting. Anthony Townsend, if you are fascinated as he is, and I am, at the ghost road ahead beyond the driverless car, it's all wrapped up in his book, and we thank you so much for being part of America Trends today. And again, I think a lot of people are going to go out and get this book and think about that future. So thanks again, Anthony. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.